May it please the court. Today, Bob Russell and I are here to ask this court to impose a 2-year stayed suspension with 3 years probation against attorney Mike Koning's license. It's not real often that our office is in agreement with opposing counsel, but I think both Bob and I believe this is a very compelling case for probation.
Do you have medical testimony regarding his mental condition?
I have his medical records that we went through in detail before we entered into the stipulation. But we did not have, it was a stipulation, so we did not have medical testimony.
No, but you had medical testimony to the effect that he was disabled when he committed these four infractions.
Yes, during a period of time there, he was at the Mayo Clinic receiving treatment. And then after that, that treatment he received up there was not very successful, and there was a subsequent suicide attempt, and I have the medical records from that. And it details quite specific details and some of the treatment that he received afterwards up until the time.
Is there testimony to the effect in your records that the illness caused the infractions of the ethical code?
I don't know that there's... The medical records don't say for sure that this was the cause, but they talk about him being despondent, him not able to function, handle specific daily activities. They don't say on, you know, John Blow's case, because he was depressed, he didn't go to court that day, which is not actually not, or he didn't return a phone call. But it was a major, severe, recurrent depression that he was diagnosed with, and when you look at the medical books on that, it says that someone with that diagnosis loses interest in most activities, has diminished energy, and diminished ability to think, concentrate, or make decisions. And I spoke to some...
And the medication didn't work, the medication from the Mayo Clinic or anyone else did not work on his helping him deal with the issue?
No, it did not.
So how would you suppose it's going to work in the future?
Well, after the suicide attempt, he had inpatient treatment both at the University of Missouri and then at St. Joseph Heartland Hospital. Change of medication, it seemed to work much better. He, and I frankly even spoke to him a day or two before his suicide attempt. He was crying to me on the phone. Since then, I've had opportunities to visit with him through formal meetings, the hearing that we had, and even today before. He's a different person. He's energetic. He's going to court. Reports that I receive is he's functioning as a normal person.
What are the provisions that you propose that would ensure ongoing use of medication or ongoing oversight to make sure that he's still able to handle these issues?
Under our probation terms, he's supposed to have an independent medical examination, which he's very willing to do, and then follow whatever recommendations that the medical professionals give, and that the medical professional will then need to, he'll sign off with the medical professional to be to give us quarterly results on
And you're recommending how long a period?
3 years.
Briefs indicate that he's paid restitution to all of his clients except the Staffords.
Yes.
What's the status of that?
As part of the stipulation, he's agreed to enter into a fee dispute with the Missouri Bar Association and abide by including paying back if it's recommended there. I don't believe that he's done that yet because he's waiting for this final decision from the court.
Do you have independent medical I would think often the doctors and the physicians that are treating him will be his advocates. You have independent medical review of whatever they submit to you?
Do we have
any independent medical examination?
We do not have we did not hire a professional to examine him, but I have the records from his suicide attempt. These were not doctors.
No, we're talking about going forward in probation. Do you have any independent...
It has to be a medical professional of our... we have to agree to that.
You have to agree to his treating...
Yes, whoever he has for that. And he has treating physicians right now who would examine him would not necessarily be who his treating physicians are.
You should require an independent person if you weren't sure.
Right.
You felt comfortable with
whoever. Right, and we know who his treating physicians are right now. I'm sure that the probation monitor would ask that he be treated by or examined by a list. We have a list of psychologists or psychiatrists that we normally send someone to.
Was it clear that the treatment that was being received at Mayo was for depression as well as for the physical injuries from the accident with the horse?
My understanding, yes. I have details on that. I'm hesitant to go into that in a public forum here. I'm sure they can elaborate on whatever Mr. Koenig was willing to report.
Are you able to advise when Mr. Koenig would have been diagnosed with depression? When did that formal diagnosis occur?
Sometime, I don't know, in May or June of that year that he was at Mayo Clinic. Initially he went up there for physical ailments, but it became evident that there was problems mentally too.
And that came from treatment at Mayo?
Yes.
And so some of the medication that he was receiving based upon the treatment at Mayo would have been treatment one would typically associate with depression?
Yes.
Including the medications?
Medications, and there were other, my understanding, other treatments besides specific medications.
The record indicated, I think there was a reference in the stipulation, that Mr. Koenig had suffered from depression for approximately on and off for around 15 years. Other than the records from Mayo and from the suicide attempt, were there other documents that were available to you to verify?
We did not go back that far. My understanding from talking to Mr. Koenig was, while he was in law school, that there was some depression at that time, but he just went to his family doctor and got some medication. There wasn't follow-up treatment as far as counseling or anything, and that it was a much less severe level of depression than what he experienced there. My understanding of, and what I even observed speaking to him on the phone, he was pretty much paralyzed by what was going on with the depression. It was a very, very severe depression.
There was a mention of the IOLTA or trust account violation. Do you have him going to trust account training school or something?
Well, he's going to ethics school. I don't believe when we did the stipulation that we had the web training that we do now via the overdrafts, but I'm sure that he'd be willing to do that seminar. And our ethics school has several hours of trust account training in that.
And you test them at the end of the ethics training to see if they've learned anything?
I don't know on the ethics training. I've not participated in that program. I know with the trust account training, that's an online webinar, and there are questions that are asked during that time that they answer online, and we can.
But they're not in a classroom when they do the trust account training. They're on a
for the overdraft. Some of what that has done is it's a computer webinar where they have to log on to their computers, and we can see what they're doing there, and there's questions that are posted, and we can see who answered and what they answered.
With respect to the trust account issues, obviously we have the information about this period of time in 09, basically beginning in January of 09. Was there any evaluation of the trust account records prior to that time to determine whether there had been compliance with trust account?
No, there was not on that. This was when the trust account overdraft, we were just starting to get notices. It wasn't even officially a rule then. In our protocol, we didn't go back real far at that time. I believe he'd only been in practice since 2006. But up until the time at the Mayo Clinic, we did see a few months before that, we didn't see anything that looked out of the ordinary.
Now, you say on the webinar, your questions asked, do you review the answers to the questions somehow on computer?
I am not sure on that. That's not something that I do directly. I've participated in a little bit. One of our paralegals tends to handle the putting that on, and there's an attorney available to answer any questions that come up, but I don't handle the specifics.
So whether they answer the questions correct or not, no one's really monitoring that.
I'm not sure on that.
And I'm sorry to be a broken record on this. I just want to feel comfortable with what the record demonstrated to you with respect to this recommendation. Some of the issues with clients occurred in nearly 6-8 months prior to the treatment at Mayo, so back in 2008. And in those situations, I believe the stipulation reflects that the money received from the clients was not deposited into the trust account. Do we have some way of verifying or knowing from the record that the depressive state that was so evident while being treated at Mayo had actually predated by some lengthy period of time that treatment?
Well, we have the fact that he was in he had the horseback accident and he was in a lot of pain. My understanding is they didn't diagnose the physical problems correctly. And we also have kind of what I call a perfect storm as far as his life going on. He took office as a prosecutor, had a huge backload, had marital problems. He was, a lot of different things were going wrong at the same time. Now, I spoke to judges up there and I spoke to some other attorneys as part of my investigation into this, and they all said that, this started after he took office, 2007, 2008, around the time that he had physical injury.
Now, three or four of his clients came forward and complained. Do you have the ability to go through the rest of his files to see if the same thing, if he didn't follow through with cases, he took fees and didn't follow through with cases on three or four situations, do you know that that is not more prevalent in his caseload?
Obviously, we didn't go through all of his files. His brother took over when he became very sick and went through those files. I'm confident that there was not major problems with that. I dealt very closely with his brother, Rick Koning, who I have a great respect with. I was probably on the phone 2 or 3 times a week with him. He was going through those files, asking me questions about, what should we do with this, and was very, very, very forthright. He told me, the good, the bad, and the ugly on all of this, and I'm not aware of any other major problems. I'm out of time, so unless someone's got some more questions.
Thank you.
May it please the court. This case comes in a little different posture than most of this type. As Ms. Ribberger indicated, we are not normally in consonance when we deal with each other, and she particularly and I are not normally in consonance. I would not describe her as the soft white underbelly of the OCDC by any stretch of the imagination. When I got into this case, I asked Nancy, I said, what are you all looking for in this case? And they told me that they thought that this was an appropriate case for a suspension with a probation. Judge Teilman, you've talked about the question of an independent examination, and I assume you're alluding to your rule 5.285 as it came from the Belts case. That rule applies only to reinstatements and to the issue of mitigation. Now, quite frankly, had we had to try this case and we'd have fleshed it out, I would have been going down another avenue besides the mitigation route, because the record would be anecdotally as well as from the medical records that when he broke. Whatever life put on him that he was unable to deal with, he couldn't deal with it. And he truly, Nancy used the word paralyzed. He was paralyzed. And I would have been trying to talk about whether or not he was diligent. Did he have the ability to be diligent when he was in this situation? Had he been in a car wreck, been in a hospital, would we be criticizing him for not being diligent if he were paralyzed? The same with the issue of his communication with the clients. We would have been fighting those not only on the mitigation end, we'd have been talking about him on the merit side of it. Did he have the capability? So there's diligence, competence, and really on the trust account, more a failure to supervise than anything. One of the worst decisions he ever made was to let his wife take over this responsibility. She wrote checks, he would sign them, whatever she gave him. But had it been going down the route, had been forced to go down the route of having to go to a hearing panel, we would have had to go through the hoops of not only having our own...
There's no question as a prosecutor, he still keeps his job as the prosecutor, is that correct?
He's no longer the prosecutor. Okay. He's given that up. The prosecution thing was really not a good job for him. He took it when it had a major backload of felony cases that he somehow felt that he was responsible for, and it basically consumed him along with the other.
And this is different from a car accident, because a car accident occurs, he has a persistent condition that needs monitoring, and the 3 years may be an adequate time to see that he's on the right track on taking medication. And that's different from the car accident case, and that's...
I understand that, but one of the things about that rule, and I'll bring it to your attention just while we're here, because it's an open question as to when you need the independent examination, and it's an item of discussion that we have. But with its position that it only applies if in mitigation circumstances, this puts the respondent, and you all need to understand that most of the respondents are guys like this. They're solo practitioners who are having difficulties, usually economic difficulties. But if you go in and say, I did it, now let's talk about mitigation, as we should. First off, you hire your own psychiatrist to tell you about that and give you some information so that you're able to analyze it. Then there's an independent, because you can't use yours, that under the rule, you can't use yours, you got to bring in an independent. You also run the risk that the OCDC may say, we want one of our own. This respondent, as every other respondent, is responsible for the cost. He can be looking at, under this rule, three psychiatrist bills to pay as a result of interposing that.
But our major concern, having seen a few violations of the code, the canons, is the public.
Absolutely.
And if it's assured by the independent, that's fine. Whatever.
Sure.
It could be satisfied in many ways, but I'm just saying our major concern is the public. The public safety
has to always be the first concern of this court, and particularly in view of the fact that we're a self-policing organization. But the process has got to be fair first. It's got to be consistent. It's got to be reasonable. It's got to be efficient, and it's got to be truly. It ought to be affordable to the people that are stuck at it.
But your client has navigated that and gotten to the point of this recommendation. And what can you say to assure this court that the public will be protected in the future were we to accept the recommendation?
Well, I'm happy to talk about that. He has, first off, limited his practice. He limits it geographically, and he limits it primarily to criminal work with which he is fairly...
And this is a change. He's sort of toned down his practice to something that's less
much
stressful.
Much different. The workers' comp and personal injury cases that he offices go to his brother, Rick, who is a very competent practitioner in those fields. His brother maintains his own trust account. Trust account issues would... As far as those dollars are concerned, which are where the substantial dollars are, go through his brother's trust account. There's never been an issue with his brother. So he's not dealing with that. His progress has been amazing from the standpoint just of being able to see him. I had exactly the same experience that Nancy did when I first saw him. He was a mess and was just in a heck of a shape. Now he's doing much better. He's, in fact, been assisting the prosecuting attorney to try some cases. He had gotten to the point he was not capable of doing that. He is not on medication at the present time. He has been able to divorce himself from the medication. and function.
And it says he's functioning or improving since going off the medication. Is that what the brief
yes,
says?
Yes, he's...
He needed it to get things under control,
yes,
but not on an ongoing basis.
Absolutely.
Your client has agreed to your client has agreed to 12 stipulations, and that's a lot. And I know these briefs were written back in August, and I'm assuming that everything has been going fine and has been able to live up to these 12 stipulations, and including finding a mentor, and maybe that's his brother who's been a tremendous help.
Well, no, his mentor is Dana McCoubry in Chillicothe, who's his dad. David is well known to you as a longtime member of the advisory committee. Dana is probably a little more reticent than his father to tell you what you need to be doing, but he's not at all shy about it. And he has been a terrific mentor and friend for Mr. Koenig in this matter.
Should this court want to extend the period of supervision or add in a requirement for a webinar in trust or similar kinds of additional conditions of probation? I take it there's no objection to that.
No, absolutely not. He's willing to do whatever needs to be done. One of the problems that we've had going back to in my brief, I mentioned, I think it's good for the system to recognize agreements that the Chief Disciplinary Counsel enters into because I think it makes the system work more easily. And as a result, in this case, we entered into a stipulation in September over a year ago, and so we're still trying to figure out where we are. And that's tough for respondents to go through that long period of time and not be able to make a plan for where you're going to go. And to me, that's one of the reasons that you ought to look favorably with what your Chief Disciplinary Counsel does in these cases. But I would tell you in this case, the suggestion originally came from the OCDC of what to do with this. Would have been the suggestion that I would have made, but I was very appreciative of it. I think it would help all of us who practice in this area, if when we reached the stip with the OCDC, we had a pretty good idea that that's where it was going to go. It makes it a situation that's much more livable, that you can say with some assurance that this is likely to happen if you do this. Back to your question, Judge Stith, he's willing to do whatever is reasonable that anybody asks him to do. He has been as compliant as anybody I've ever dealt with in dealing with this. Nancy calls it a perfect storm. Perhaps it was. But life puts things on us, some of us function and go through life, and nobody ever thinks you ever had a problem. There are other people that they fold and they never can get over the problem. My assessment of Rick is that he's one of those people that he's had the problem. He has been at the bottom of the barrel.
Judge Russell, your client's very ably represented. But I must say, there are a lot of things that happen in OCDC that they do a tremendous job. We just review a few of them every so often, so it's not like...
You've been on a hot streak here for about 2-3 months, but that's a little bit of a change, and I understand that. He has been as good as anybody I've ever dealt with, and I truly think that he has exemplifies that old saying, that what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. And I think he's stronger. I think he's much less judgmental. He wanted to blame most of his problems on his ex-wife, but he's come in my discussions with him to an understanding that it's him, it's not her.
I wouldn't quote Nietzsche on many things in this day.
I think it's a sensible disposition with sensible conditions, and he's had no problems in the period of time since we've signed this, and he's got a relationship with the lady. His young son is living with him at home now, and he's got an office arrangement that is not on the high end of anything, but it's economically feasible for him, and it works. And I would certainly commend to you that you approve the stipulation, and if there are additional conditions, certainly we're willing to abide by them and appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a couple of remarks. I've dealt with a lot of attorneys in the past 9 years that I've been with the office that I think that probably had some severe mental health issues. Very few of those have I personally entered into stipulations with. And the few that I've done, it's always been challenging because the person has trouble even negotiating the stipulation and following through. Mr. Koenig's been probably the only person that I've dealt with on the stipulation that he's done everything that I've asked so far of him. When I submitted the stipulation to him, typically there's a going back and forth of changes. He said, fine. Never argued about any of the terms, which surprised me. I think that's the first time in 9 years that that's ever happened. And he said, bring it on. You know, all of this, he said, some of this I might not need, but it's not going to hurt me. I'm willing to do it. That's the only time that I've had in the past 9 years with someone with a mental health issue that has been able to step up to the plate and has taken responsibility and seems very willing to do it. And I can personally see that he's a very different person than even a year ago when we entered into the stipulation. So that I would ask that the court approve the stipulation. And I think he could serve as an example to other attorneys that you can recover and have a productive life as an attorney after having major mental illness.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.